Hi, everyone. It's Lindy. I hope you're having a great day. I know I sure am. Listen, before we get started with the podcast today, I just wanted to make a quick mention that today's episode deals with organ donation. I have a wonderful guest on the show who's sharing her story about being the recipient of kidney transplants. It's an amazing story, but I did think it was important that I mention that before we get started, just in case you have any sensitivity with the subject of organ donation. That is what today's episode is about. So I wanted to put that out ahead of time. Also, just to remind you that I am a hobby podcaster and I don't have any great big doctor letters behind my name. I am Lindy. I am not Dr. Lindy. So this podcast does not provide any medical or legal advice in any way. It's basically a guest who's come on the show, very kindly shared her story with us. But if you have any questions at all, I do encourage you to please reach out to your own healthcare and medical professionals. So I hope you enjoy today's episode. It definitely is an eye-opener.
You're listening to Lindy's Audio Cafe, a positive and lighthearted podcast. Life gets busy, and in the race for happiness, we sometimes forget what is truly important. In the end, it's often the smaller things in life that truly matter. Stick around. There's always something new to talk about, and we're glad to have you join us. Thanks for listening, and here's your host, Lindy.
Hello there, and welcome to Lindy's Audio Cafe. My name is Lindy, and I'm absolutely delighted to be back in the podcast chair once again today. Today's going to be really unique, and this is an episode that you're going to want to listen to from start to finish, and it's going to give you such an appreciation for life as it is. I have a guest here with me today. Her name is Tina Gile. Now, Tina Gile was born in Liverpool in the United Kingdom, and she moved to Canada in the early 1980s. And the journey definitely took a turn when she got to Canada. She encountered quite a health crisis, and it's a story that you really need to hear. So I'm going to start by introducing Tina, saying hello, and we're going to let Tina share her story with us over a little cup of coffee this morning. Hi, cheers. Tina.
Hello. Hi, Linda.
How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I am just delighted to have you here.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm delighted to be here.
And any snow in your neck of the woods? I've got a little bit here.
No, not here in Arizona. Actually, there's none back home in Ontario, I don't think, either. So.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, so that's good.
That is a good thing. So you've got quite a story to share. You've been through quite the journey. You're an amazing woman. You are incredible. And I'd love to let you start by telling us about what happened when you came to Canada.
Well, my husband and I moved to Canada in 1981. I came in the March of 81. And, we planned on starting a family, and this was our home now. And in 1985, I was lucky enough to get pregnant. We had been trying. And then 4 or 5 months into the pregnancy, I had a miscarriage. So, which, you know, was okay. The doctor said, you know, most first pregnancies will have a miscarriage at some point. So, but the thing is, when they tested the placenta, they found that it was cancerous.
Oh, no.
So I got a call from my gynecologist and said, you need to get to the hospital right away, because the type of cancer that is in the uterus, if left, it could actually travel to the brain. And I got this phone call at work. Oh. So one of my work colleagues, because, you know, I was quite shaken, obviously. So one of my work colleagues actually called my husband, and we only had the one car at the time. So my work colleague drove me to my husband's place of work, and then he took me to the hospital. So I started chemo. I was hospitalized for 4 days at a time for the chemo. So I had 6 months of chemo, and I was only 28 at the time. So they did not give me, or they did not want to give me, a hysterectomy because of my age, being so young and hopefully get pregnant in the future. So I had 6 months of chemo, and I came out of that great. They said everything was clear, but I had to be 5 years cancer-free before I could try and get pregnant again, which was okay. I was only 28. So unfortunately, after the very first chemo treatment, I got a little sick. So they took me back into the hospital and did some tests, and they realized that the chemo had affected my kidneys.
Oh.
So, yeah. So I didn't lose my hair, but it attacked my kidneys for some reason. So they monitored me over the course of the next 5 years, and it just, my kidney function just got progressively worse. So actually, it was only about 3 or 4 days before I would have been 5 years cancer-free that my kidneys actually failed.
Oh, no.
So I was never able to have children because back then, this was 1991, when I had my first transplant, back then you couldn't get pregnant with a kidney transplant. So, so I went on, let me see here. I had to go in to the hospital, and they gave me, and my whole family attended, and they gave us a demonstration of the different kinds of dialysis that you can have. There's two. And the dialysis replaces what your kidneys would normally do. So we went, and there's peritoneal dialysis and there's hemodialysis. And the difference in those is hemo, they put a fistula, like a tube in your arm. They surgically implant it, and you dialyze on a machine 3 times a week. The other dialysis is peritoneal dialysis. And the difference with that one is they surgically implant a catheter into your belly and you dialyze every day. So it's a better way to me. That was my personal choice. It's a better way of dialyzing because on hemo, you tend to have the peaks and valleys. On the day you dialyze, you feel really good. And, you know, you start to fall on the days in between. On peritoneal dialysis, you're dialyzing every day, 4 times a day, so you're steady. Plus, your diet isn't restricted. On hemo, you have to watch your potassium intake and fluid intake. So I chose peritoneal dialysis. And so I started, they installed the catheter in me in the February of 1991. They put the catheter ready to get ready for dialysis.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, a month later, I needed dialysis. My creatinine, which is the way they measure your kidney function, my creatinine was up into the 1300s, which was very, very high. And they couldn't use the catheter in my belly yet because it wasn't healed. So I had to have emergency dialysis into the neck here. It's the subclavian. They put a port in there, and then you dialyze on the machine. So I only had to do that for 3 or 4 weeks, and then my catheter was healed. So I was able to start dialysis. And so I went on the list. All of my family members were tested. And my younger sister, who lives in Canada, she wasn't tested at the time. But my older sister in the UK, my husband, his family, a couple of friends, they were all tested and none of them were a match. So I have O negative blood type, which is the more rare. Like O negative can give to other blood types, but I can only receive O negative. So it's more difficult to get a match. So I was lucky. I was only on the waiting list for 4 days. And I got my kidney. Now, before that, you have to be hospitalized. They do a whole bunch of tests. They do a psych evaluation. They test. You have to be really healthy to have a transplant. It's a big toll on your body, and it's a lot of medication after the fact. So I had the surgery. I was actually 4 days on the list. I wasn't even in the system when I got the call. That's how quickly it was.
That's amazing that happened so quickly for you. And I mean, it sounds like your whole life had just changed done a 180 at that point. You were, your whole life pretty much, it sounds like, was in the hospital at that point.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I spent a lot of time in the hospital. Yeah. I got to know the staff very well. But
like your second family when you're there, yeah, right? They really are. Yeah.
Because my family would, my sister and my husband would come to my dialysis treatments while I was dialyzing through the neck in the hospital. And then the peritoneal dialysis you do at home. So I was doing that at home. But my dad was over from England at the time on vacation when I had my first transplant. So when I got the call, we had just been out for dinner. And when we got home, the phone rang and it was the transplant center saying that they had a kidney for me. And I couldn't believe it. And my dad was more on the pessimist side. He goes, oh, you know, it might be a mistake. You know, don't get your hopes up just in case. So I said, okay, we packed a bag real quickly and we drove to London and I had my first transplant.
Wow. That's huge.
All they tell you, like, I don't know who they are. They don't know who I am. They just told me that it was a long weekend when I had my transplant. It was the July 1st holiday. So there's more accident victims, I guess, on long weekends. So all they told me was that it was a young male and it was an accident victim.
Wow.
Yeah.
Gut-wrenching. So,
it really is. Yeah. It's, you know, because here's me celebrating life and somebody, you know, had to pass away for that. So that's difficult in itself. But you know what? It was fantastic. Like the difference with a kidney transplant makes rather than being on dialysis. And the peritoneal is quite, well, you dialyze four times a day, which each exchange takes about 45 minutes. But because of my size, they were 1 liter bags. And how that works is you have an IV pole and the 1 liter bags are full of a solution that when it goes into your belly, it clears the toxins out of your body, just like the kidneys would do. So really it works as a kidney function. And so you have an IV on a pole and the fluid, the bag gets attached to the catheter in my belly. And then that fluid goes into your belly and it stays in there doing its job till the next exchange. And then what you have to do then is you have to unhook it, put the bag on the floor, it's still attached to the catheter, and drain that fluid out and then put a new bag in.
I'm sorry. There's probably a lot of training. I bet you had a lot of training to be able to know to do that. Who trained you? Who did you have a team that helped with that?
Yeah. There's a whole, I'm fortunate. Like my surgery was in London, Ontario. That's where the transplant center is.
Yeah.
But we have a dialysis center in Windsor where I live. So that was great. So we had to go to my whole family, actually, my husband, my sister, a couple of friends came. We all went and it took about a week and a half to do the training and then they come in every day to the home and a dialysis nurse will come in and monitor you. They have to, you know, weigh you because you can't go over a certain weight because it's bad for the kidneys. And so they monitored me every day when I was at home. So I was only on dialysis the first time for 4 weeks.
Okay.
Which was very, very, you know, that's pretty much unheard of. And then, as I say, 4 days on the waiting list, and I had my kidney. Now, it didn't kick in right away, unfortunately. So I was in the hospital for 3 weeks while they were trying to kickstart it. So one of the nurses had, and I'll never forget this, one of the nurses had actually said to me, you know, in her experience, she said, most of the best kidney transplants have never kicked in right away. And I went, oh my gosh, wow, really? Because I was getting worried, you know, when it's not working.
Yeah.
And my dad was getting worried. And so they were just about to start after about 2.5 weeks in the hospital. They were just about to kickstart me with dialysis to try and kickstart the kidney. They did a biopsy on the kidney to see if there was anything wrong with it, and there wasn't. It was just a slow starter. And the day before they were going to do kickstart with me with dialysis, my kidney kicked in.
So what's kickstart? I'm not familiar with that.
Kickstart is they dialyze you. okay. to try and kickstart the kidney, because it was just okay. sitting there, and but it just wasn't doing its function.
Okay.
Once they measure the kidney function, anybody's kidney function, by your creatinine level. And a normal person, you know, with two working kidneys, an average creatinine would be anywhere from 50 to 90 or 100, like in between that. When I had my first transplant, my creatinine was at 1300.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And it's a very weird experience, because your body fills up with toxins, you know, so you get very sick because the toxins aren't doing the function. Like normally what you would do is you would pee them out, you know, yeah. your kidney. And I wasn't doing that. So
were you nauseous? Like what kind yeah. of symptoms did you have? Nausea?
I had nausea. I had anemia. My blood pressure went through the roof. I was lethargic, couldn't get out of bed.
Wow.
My legs were all swollen. My whole body was jittery, like constantly shaking because of the toxins building up. So that's when they had to do that emergency dialysis on me until the catheter worked wow. in. But
very scary. Yeah. Must have been very frightening for you at the time.
It is. I mean, they had yeah. explained everything, but still, when it didn't kick in right away, and you think, oh my gosh, like have I just gone through this surgery for nothing, you know? But it did kick in, and it was fantastic. It was night and day. The difference I felt immediately once it had started working was insurmountable. Like I had so much energy. I had an appetite. I can't even explain how the difference, because dialysis, although it's good, a lot of people are on dialysis for life. It does the job that the kidneys, you know, would normally do, but it's not only it's time consuming, but the longer you're on dialysis, the unhealthier you get, you know? So it's a catch-22. You need it, but you know, you don't stay healthy. So the difference was amazing.
Wow, that's huge.
Yeah, and I had my transplant in the June, and I was back at work in the October. And I was back riding my bike in the end of July, because I like to cycle. So I was back riding my bike and going back to the gym. And we bought a condo in Scottsdale, where I am now, and I hike every day. And my kidney, I'm checked every 6 months now. But after 5 years in the first transplant, I got an episode of rejection. It started to reject. So I'm back in the hospital, and they gave me a high dosage of steroids to try and reverse it. And they managed to reverse it. So that was after 5 years. My first kidney lasted 18 years.
Wow, that's incredible.
It is, because yeah. they told me before I had my transplant, because of my age, they said I would probably over a lifetime have to have three. Because they don't last. A kidney transplant does not last. You have a better chance if it's a family member donating of the kidney lasting longer. But when it's a non-family, they told me on average at the time was about 10 years. And I got 18 years.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And slowly but surely it started to reject. And I knew, I could tell by the way I was feeling, and my ankle started to swell. And so they did the workup for me to try and start the process again for a second transplant. And so that was back. My second transplant was in 2009. And now they've changed it. So you have to actually be on dialysis now before you go on the waiting list. In my first transplant back in 91, that wasn't the case. You passed all the health checks, and then you went on the list. But now they've changed it. So I started dialysis in the February of 2009, and I was only on the list for 3 months the second time. I got a call on the 3rd of May 2009 to say that they had another kidney for me, and off I went to London for the second transplant.
Wow, that's huge. That's London, Ontario.
London, Ontario.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing.
My whole family came in. In fact, my husband, the second time, was in China. He was working in China, so he wasn't even here when I got the call. So my sister and brother-in-law and two nieces, we all drove up to the hospital, and the kids were only, you know, young at the time. They brought the pajamas. It was a big adventure for them because they were in the pajamas in the hospital. And this kidney kicked in right away. It started to work immediately.
That's amazing. And you had all your family with you. Now, how long is the surgery? Like, how long is the actual time in the OR?
It's about 6 hours.
That's a long surgery.
Yeah, yes.
That's a long time.
Yeah. Well, the surgeon, the second time came out and told my brother-in-law and my sister that it had kicked in immediately. And when I say kick in immediately, that means you're producing urine. The kidney produces urine. And so he came out and he said, you know, due to the stature, the small stature of my frame, they had to kind of shift things around a bit to get the kidney in because it was quite a large kidney. I've never looked back. It's very emotional because, you know, somebody had to die to give me life. And I will never, never take that for granted.
And I can imagine every day, you probably cherish every day that you're here.
I do. I mean, I have the attitude that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I'm a firm believer in that.
You're a very strong person.
Yeah.
You're very strong.
And you know, I didn't even realize I was that strong until, you know, you go through these challenges in life. And my girlfriend used to say to me, oh my gosh, how do you do it? But I just, especially with a transplant, because of the nature of it, you know, somebody has lost a family member. And I write a letter to the donor families every 5 years.
That's amazing. You don't connect with them in person though, right?
No.
Is that done through the organization that manages it?
There's a donor coordinator and the recipient coordinator. And how the letters work was when I had my first transplant, I wrote a letter right away. And what I have to do is they will never know who I am.
Yeah.
And I will never know who they are. I just know that it was a young male accident victim. So after my first transplant, when I got home and started feeling better, I wrote the family a letter. And all I can say in the letter is, my name is Tina. I can't give them a second name. I can give them my age and the city where I live. And then I go on in, you know, thanking them and telling them what a difference it's made in my life. So, and then you can't seal it. I have to give it to my transplant coordinator, who reads it, make sure there's nothing personal in there, that they would know who I was. And then she passes it on to the donor coordinator, who then passes it on to the family.
Wow. That's amazing that you're able to do that. And it's you're sharing your gratitude with this family that you've managed to continue with your life. And it really highlights the importance for organ donations. I mean, we hear about it all the time. We see it in television ads. We see it in, you know, newspapers and that. And I'm not sure how it is in your area. I think here you can actually do it through your driver's license. I think there's a form we fill out down there to have that on our record. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I know there are forms that you can fill out to have your name registered for that.
Yes, you can do it. You can do it. Well, in Ontario, you can do it on your driver's license. And now you can do it on your government health card. You can sign into the government of Ontario and actually go on to your health card and, you know, opt to be a donor. And you can even pick which organs you want to donate and which ones you don't.
I think it's the same here, because I do remember filling something out, and I'm pretty sure it was when I did my driver's license, there was a form I could fill out and submit. I believe so.
Yeah. Well, I've had so many people come up to me over the last, my gosh, 30 some years since my first transplant, and say, you know, we've signed our donor card because of you. And I, honestly, I was 28 when I got cancer. And then, you know, 5 years later, I was on dialysis. I didn't think about it myself. It was the last thing I thought about to actually donate my organs. Well, you don't when you're young, you know, you just don't think about it. And wow, like it's just so important. But more important than that is than signing your donor card, because signing your donor card, and a lot of people don't know this, signing your donor card isn't the end of it. You have to have, because I'll give you an example. See, you, for instance, you know, unfortunately, God willing, never happens, but you're in the hospital and you're on life support and you have signed your donor card and all your family are around you. And of course, it's a very, very trying time for your family. And there's only, you have a short time frame to take those organs. And the transplant team come in, talk to your family members because you've signed your donor card. If just one of your family members says, no, I'm not comfortable with this, they can't take them.
Are you serious? Mm-hmm. I didn't know about that. I've never heard of that. I wonder if that's all jurisdictions or just where you live?
I think it's right across Canada. Wow.
I've never heard of that. Yeah. So,
yeah, even though you've signed your donor card, if just one family member objects, they cannot take those organs. So besides signing your donor card, the most important thing that I can tell anyone is have that conversation with your family. Have it. Tell them what your wishes are. You know, I've signed a donor card. If anything happens to me, I want to donate these organs, and that's my wishes. Because you know, it's very difficult. If one person says no, they can't do it. And they're not going to say, well, you know, she signed the donor. They're not going to have that conversation because it's the trying time. They're going to take you off life support. So they just won't do it. So it's conversation. Have that conversation with your family. I even have it in my will.
I think I do too, to be honest with you. The wheels are turning right now as we're talking with somebody. I'm pretty sure that I've got that in there now. It's actually interesting because now I'm going to go back and I'm going to check to make sure that I've got everything covered and that I've got it noted, because I know how important it is. And it's not just kidneys. Yeah. It could be your heart. It could be eyes. It could be anything that, you know, would definitely help somebody else to be able to continue on with their life. And I look at you and I think how vibrant you are and how much you celebrate life. You are vibrant and you get out there and you're exercising, you're active, you're not a couch potato by any means.
Heck no.
So, I mean, so what kinds of things do you do? You mentioned that you're hiking and biking. Do you do that every day? Or
At home, I cycle every day and I go to the gym probably 2 or 3 times a week. And then when I'm here in Arizona, I have a bike here and I do cycle, but I love to hike here. I just love it. It's just my passion. So I try to go every morning, Monday to Friday. I don't do weekends because it's just too busy. And I like to go before the sun comes up.
It's a great time of day, isn't it?
I love it. Oh my gosh, it's just my happy place. I go there and I like to do I try to do each time I'm here at least 1 or 2 new trails. And some of them are quite difficult. There's a mountain in Scottsdale here called Camelback, and you can hike it from both sides. And it's very strenuous, it's very difficult. And I've done both sides, I did both.
Good for you.
I wanted to do it. I said to my husband, I am going to do it. So in the November of 21, I did the one side of it, the Cholo side. And then in February of 22, I did the other side. And it took me a long time. It took me a while because in some parts of it, you're literally scaling up the side of a mountain.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. But when I got to the top, oh my gosh, it was just exhilarating. And I had met, when I did the second one, the other side of it in February, I met a guy going up and he said to me, are you hiking this? And I went, yes. He goes, do you mind if I join you? I go, of course. And so anyway, he does this every day. He does this mountain every day. And he had just come off the Appalachian Trail. It took him 5 months to do the Appalachian Trail. So this guy was really fit. thank goodness he was with me, because I'm not sure I would have been able, had the courage to do it, because it was quite difficult. And so he showed me where to put my feet, where to put my hands, when to bend. And he got me to the top. And when I got there, we took a selfie. And I said to him, "This is, oh my gosh, like I'm just looking around." And he said, I was 62 at the time. And he went, "I don't know many 62-year-old women that could do this with what you've gone through," because I told him my whole story, and which I like to do. And I said, "Okay, you've got me up. Now you've got to get me down."
Oh, problem.
So anyway, he got me down, and I was, "Oh my gosh, thank you so much," because I don't think there were some parts that were really challenging. I said, "I don't think I would have done it if it hadn't have been for you." And we've stayed friends on Facebook ever since.
That's
and
amazing.
When I was here, when I was here this spring, I came back, I came down here for my 65th birthday. And there's another one, it's a difficult one. There's and it's called Piestewa Peak. So I thought, I'm going to do it. I'm going to try and do it. So I went there, and I've since done it twice. And I posted on Facebook, and John, the guy I had met to take me up Camelback, he goes, "Oh my gosh, Tina, I am so proud of you." Because I like taking pictures of me at the top, you know, and just, yeah, that's what I love to do. I love, love hiking.
And you're on top of the world, literally.
I am, yeah.
There, you know, yeah, on top of the world.
Yeah, a couple of my friends have posted that on Facebook. "Oh my gosh, look at you. You're on top of the world."
That's great.
Yeah, and now it's going to be 14 years in May since my second transplant. And so far, everything is really, really good. My creatinine levels are all stable, you know, and I'm checked every 6 months, once in Windsor in January, and then I drive to London, Ontario in July, and I'm checked there. This will be my first in-person in London in July since before COVID. It was all telephone appointments, obviously. Nobody was going into hospitals. And so I had my first in-person appointment in January with my nephrologist in Windsor. And he just, I don't know, he just loves me. He just says to me often, "I wish all of my patients were like you. I wish they had that positive attitude that you have." And when I saw him in January, he went, "Oh my gosh, I've missed you. It's been 3 years since I've seen you." And we got chatting, and I asked him, "Have you managed to avoid COVID?" And he said, "No, unfortunately." He said, "I had it a month ago." And he said, all of his patients, he said, I don't have a patient or anybody that I know personally that hasn't had COVID. And I said, "I haven't." And he went, "What? You haven't?" And I went, "No, my husband and I, everybody around us has had COVID, but I haven't and my husband hasn't." And he went, "You're not only perfect on paper." He goes, "You're just perfect." He just made a joke. And he said, which was very, very sad, in 2020, he lost more patients in 2020 to COVID than he's ever lost in his career.
Wow, that's horrible.
Patients, that is, you know. And
I guess tells you that the immune system, like, you definitely, when they talk about COVID and people who are immune compromised, that's a classic example of why we have to be careful around people who do have, you know, immune compromised systems, because not all of us are in the same boat when we're side by side.
No. And we, as a transplant patient, we have to take immunosuppressant drugs, because what happens is when they put that kidney in, your immune system automatically wants to kick it out. It's a foreign object. You know, they want to reject it because it shouldn't be there. It's not your native kidney. So we have to take medication. It's called triple therapy. And we have to take medication that suppresses our immune system. And so I technically don't have an immune system, because I'm taking drugs to suppress it. Because if I ever stopped taking those drugs, my kidney would eventually reject. Because my immune system, my natural immune system would start to build up and recognize that kidney is a foreign object and shouldn't be there, and it will reject. So I'm stringent. Every 12 hours, I have to take this medication. And there's horrible side effects with the meds.
As there is, I was going to ask that. Like, is it hard on your system? Is it hard on your digestive system or headaches or anything?
Yeah,
like that,
it's very hard. Well, it comprises of, at least in Ontario, it comprises of prednisone, Advogras, and Myfortic. That's the triple therapy. The prednisone, well, I've been on it since 1991, with the exception of that short period in my second transplant when I was on dialysis. And my bones are very, very brittle. My skin is super thin, like I bruise very easily. I'm at high risk for broken bones if I fall because my bones are very brittle because of it. I have osteoarthritis, osteoporosis, you name it, I have it. But that's just the side effects from the medication. And then the Advogras, unfortunately, over time causes cancer.
Oh, no.
So in particular skin cancers.
Okay.
So which I've had. I've had probably 10, maybe 10, 11 skin cancers removed. Some of them have been cancerous and some of them have been precancerous. The worst one being I had in 2018 or 2019, I don't remember now, I had a big tumor on the top of my head. So it had been tested all through the years because it had been there a while and it was fine. But there came a point where it would scab and it wouldn't heal. So I had a biopsy done of it and it was cancerous.
Oh, no.
So I had to go in, see a plastic surgeon. And she said, okay, we have two options. We can either, when we take it out, we can either do a skin graft where we'll take skin from your arm or your thigh and we'll put it on your scalp, but your hair will not grow back. You'll always have a bald patch. Or we can do a total scalp restructure. And I said, okay, how does that work? And she said, well, we cut it out. We cut around the scalp and we pull your scalp over.
Ooh.
And I said, will my hair grow back? And she said, yes, this option. So that's the option I chose.
Must have been painful. Was it very painful after?
It was. It was very painful after. It was a lot of massive headaches after.
Oh, that's horrible.
But I was more concerned about my hair. Like, is it going to grow back? And sure enough, I mean, I had 36 stitches because the tumor was 5 centimeters, but they not only had to stitch inside, but they had to stitch the outside, obviously. And, you know, it took a while to heal. And my hair, as you can see, did grow back.
You've got beautiful hair.
Yeah. So, you know, and that's, it's probably a combination of, well, it is definitely the medication, the Advogras. But also being in the sun. So now, you know, I don't go in the sun. I have to wear sunscreen. I have to wear a hat. I hate wearing hats. I just don't like it, but I have to. And that's just, you know, everyday life now for me. Now I just wear a hat. And if that's the worst I have to do, then, you know, it's nothing.
Lots of sunscreens and covering up. And then you mentioned that you exercise early in the morning. So that's probably a good thing because you're beating it, you know, before the rays come out.
Yeah.
And, you know, the rays get intense. It's always a good idea when you exercise early in the morning. You can kind of be part of the day.
Especially in Arizona because the heat is so intense. And when I go, I mean, some of my friends think, why do you take these risks? Because sometimes I go to these mountains and I'm the only one there. And it's pitch black when I start the hikes because the sun hasn't come up. But I'm so adventurous, you know, and I like traveling by myself. My husband worked away for the longest time. So I've been to Australia by myself. My trip of a lifetime was to go on an African safari. And I did that in 2015. My husband was working in China. And I said to him, okay, I really want to do this. And I said, do you have a problem with it? And he went, no. He said, maybe don't go to Johannesburg or somewhere where it's a bit more dangerous. So I contacted a travel company in London, England. And they specialize in high-end travel for women traveling alone. And it was phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. And I'm a big Bruce Springsteen fan. I followed him all over the US and I went to Australia to see him, where I actually met him.
But you met him?
Yes, I met him. I ended up staying in the same hotel as him. I didn't know I was. This is in 2003. And I went to see him in Brisbane, Australia. And I have a girlfriend actually who did the first podcast. She lives in Sydney. And I telephoned her and I said, okay, Bruce is coming to Brisbane. I said, I want to see the Crocodile Hunter too while I'm there. I said, is it okay if I get my Bruce ticket sent to your house? So she said, yeah, okay. So I got my Bruce ticket before I even had my plane booked or anything. And off I went. And when I'm in the hotel, it had like a rooftop pool. And I had told the bellboy when I checked in, you know, because I tend to talk a lot and just get so excitable. And I goes, oh my gosh, I'm here to see Bruce. And I'm all the way from Canada. And the next day was the concert. So I went, because of time difference, I was still awake really early. And I went and laid by the pool. And in comes Bruce Springsteen.
And you're a major fan.
Yeah, his wife and his kids were there. Yeah. And I just bumped right into him. I went, oh my gosh, this is like Bruce Springsteen. And I had my Bruce book. My girlfriend had bought me a Bruce Springsteen book. I had it with me. So I just asked him, would you mind signing a book for me?
And was he good about it?
He was very great. And I apologized. I said, I know you probably don't get a lot of downtime. And I'm a big fan. I've come from Canada to see you. And he signed it for me. He signed it for my friend, Teresa. And he was just very, very gracious.
Very kind. And I know what you're saying, because I know one time when I was traveling with my family, we ran into a very famous person, and the bodyguards right away had their hands up saying, hey, he's here with his family, you know, don't interrupt. And at that time, it was a quite a famous actor. He turned around and said, oh, for the little girl, I will. And he signed her book, and she didn't know who he was. She was five years old at the time. But I know that that day it really made me aware of, you know, being respectful in that of, you know, when movie stars or musicians or that sort of thing are on their time off. But it sounds like he definitely was very kind.
Yeah. He was.
And you're not an aggressive person either.
No,
you're very respectful.
I even thought about not doing it. And I thought, my gosh, I might never get this opportunity again. And I did have a camera. This is before cell phones. This is in 2003. I had my camera. And the security guard did come over to me and says, please don't take pictures of the children. And I said, I would never, never do that.
Then
the week later, I went to the Australia Zoo and I met Steve Irwin.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
And did you know that was going to happen ahead of time, or was that luck of the draw?
They were my two heroes, Bruce Springsteen and Steve Irwin. And I was in Australia. But I had contacted the zoo ahead of time and I said, okay, you know, is he around or, you know, what's the protocol? And she said, well, we can never tell. He's off everywhere. But anyway, he just happened to be there, flew in that day that I was there. And she goes, when you get to the zoo, come meet, we'll have a coffee. And so we had a coffee and she said, if I see him, I'll come and tell you. And anyway, she caught up with me at the zoo and she said, he's going to be doing one of his crocodile hunter demonstrations where he feeds the crocs. And she told me where. So I went to that and it was great. Yes. And I didn't meet him then. I went back a couple of days after. I thought just before I went home, I thought, you know, I only saw half the zoo. So anyway, I ended up just wandering around by myself. There was nobody around. And I just literally ran into him and a cameraman. And they were filming an episode of The Crocodile Hunter. So I just stood back. And I didn't take my camera out or anything. I thought, oh my gosh. And so the cameraman kind of looked at me and then Steve Irwin said, okay, cut. And he came right up to me, stood in front of he said, you can take a picture. So he stood like this, you know, larger than life, and let me take pictures of him. And 5 minutes, there was no sign of him. He was gone. I thought, oh my gosh, did that just happen?
It's so, like you just have these chance meetings and it's like your life has been full of excitement, but this was positive excitement for you.
It was great, because if I didn't have, I mean, I keep thinking to myself, if I didn't have the pictures to prove it, I don't think anybody would believe me. No, come on. You met these two people? I don't think so, but I have the photos, so it was great.
And then you can tell them another story. Yeah, and I've had a couple kidney transplants. See if they believe that.
Yeah, well, it's when I had my second transplant, I had actually tickets to go see Bruce in Toronto. And I got the call 3 days before the concert. So as they're wheeling me down to the OR for my surgery, I had two male nurses, and I said to them, I couldn't bribe you to take me straight to the Rogers Center, could you, to see Bruce? I said, because I'm going to miss the concert. And they went, no, you know, unfortunately. Anyway, I missed the concert, but a friend of mine later bought me a photo frame for concert tickets. And she said, I want you to put that concert ticket in there, in that frame, and say with the story attached to it, because you couldn't go because you had a kidney transplant. So I did. I did that. So.
And do you still have that? Do you have that in the frame somewhere?
Yeah, I do.
And is it up on your wall? Do you look at it all the time?
Yes, I do. I have my signed book that he signed. I have that. And I have, you know how the crocodile hunter used to wear those khaki shirts?
Okay.
I bought one at the zoo and I had him sign that.
Oh, so neat.
Yeah.
And you still have it? You still have that to this day?
I still have it to this day.
Good for you.
And I still have the pen that Bruce held to sign my book.
You truly are a dedicated fan. Absolutely.
I'm actually going to see him in Detroit at the end of March. Now that I'm a little nervous about because of COVID, because, you know, that's been a different ride for transplant recipients, you know, because we're so vulnerable. And, you know, COVID, how we react to COVID is completely different to the general public, because, well, there has been a lot of transplant patients that have passed away from it. And I know regular people have too. But I am still wearing my mask everywhere indoors. Yeah. My husband too. We, you know, even here in Arizona, not many people wearing masks here. But I'm not going to take that chance. We've done 3 years without having COVID now. I don't want to, you know, to jinx anything. But that concert, that's a little nerve-wracking. Because yeah. I won't have been indoors anywhere, even with my mask, with that many people. Yeah. So I'm a little, you know, nervous about that. But I'm going to go. I'm still going to go. I'm not going to miss it. If I have to double mask, I'll double mask. And, you know, it is what it is. So hopefully everything will be okay.
Yeah. So you have lots of good things in the works, many things that you're still planning to do.
Yes.
And I love your zest for life, because you don't let things knock you down. It's just like, okay, no. I've been there. I've dealt with that. Carry on. What's the next step forward? And that seems to be how you look at things. And I find it an inspiration, you know,
because thank you.
Well, it's true, because some of us, we get a little bit, well, I don't want to call myself a whiner, but every now and then I'll find my, you know, I'll whine about something and I go, yeah, I've got this little ache or pain or whatever, or something that's a minor problem, but none of it is on the scale of what you've dealt with. And it's a real reminder to those of us, you know, who have minor aches and pains, whatever, to take a look at it and look at the whole perspective and realize that we're really lucky to be where we are. And we're actually really lucky to live in a country where those facilities are available. You know, those things are available. I had a family member who did a 7-hour operation at BC Children's Hospital. And I know at that time I became so grateful for our medical profession and so grateful for the donations, the people that support those hospitals, because without that, we wouldn't have the lives that we have. Like, we're very, very, very lucky.
We are so fortunate to live in Canada. It's a great country. And I mean, we have a home in the US, but I'm always glad to get back to Canada. You know, and I don't know, I've never been, my glass has always been half full. Even before I got sick, it's always been half full. And in fact, after my first transplant, I was approached by one of the transplant team to see if I would, because of my attitude, go in and talk to dialysis patients that were on the fence about transplant. And I turned it down because I thought, no, I make it too attached, or if, you know, if they get the transplant and something happens, how is that going to affect me? Yeah. And then I thought about it and I thought, no, you know what? I'm going to do it, because if anyone is a good example of how transplant affects your life post-dialysis, it's me. And everything that I've been able to accomplish because of those transplants. So I did. I went in and they told me which patients were, you know, kind of thinking about it. And I didn't go in all gung-ho. And, you know, I just sat with them and talked and listened to them and shared my story. And my blue story always comes up, the crocodile, everything. Every nutty thing that I've ever done. I've gotten over the years. I haven't done it since COVID. They've actually stopped it right now because of the pandemic. But before COVID, over the years, you know, 5 people have gotten off that machine and into a transplant that I've talked to.
That's incredible.
Because they're scared. And I get it. They're scared. You know, it's a big adjustment to your life, and it's a positive adjustment. And I don't sugarcoat anything. I tell them about the side effects of the medications and all of that. I don't hide anything, but I think they were able to see what it has done for my life. And if I'd have been on dialysis, I wouldn't have been able to do any of that.
You wouldn't be climbing those mountains. You wouldn't be traveling the way that you are.
No, I wouldn't. In fact, when I had my first, when I was on dialysis the first time, I thought, you know, my husband and I had an African safari booked in 1991. And 3 days before we were due to go, I got the call for the kidney. So obviously that didn't happen. Hence why I went in 2015. And I thought, you know what? This isn't going to hold me down. I'm going to do some research on travel and being on dialysis. So at the time, I actually found a dialysis cruise.
Oh, cool.
And it cruised all around the Caribbean, and it had the room set up. It was for dialysis patients, hemo and peritoneal dialysis. And you could go and you could dialyze and still go on a cruise. And I had all the information. Thankfully, I didn't have to use it because I got the kidney. But yes, there are options out there.
That's amazing. I think that's wonderful because, I mean, life goes on, right? You still want to keep living. You still want to do things. Because I was going to ask you that. I didn't know if there was portable options. What happens if you just want to go camping? If you're on dialysis, can you go camping? Can you take machines with you? Or is that a no-go? Does that mean you've got to stay close to home base?
Yeah, like, I don't think you'd be able to go camping. Not unless you were close to, if you were on hemodialysis especially, not unless you're close to a transplant center where you can actually go on your dialysis days and then go back to the camp.
Yeah.
Peritoneal dialysis in camping and things like that, I would say no, because it has to be done in a completely sterile environment.
Oh, okay.
Like we had to have a room in our house completely sterile. You know, you have to go in, you wear a mask. Anybody that comes in with you to see you dialyze, they have to wear a mask. So it's very, very sterile. But when I was doing dialysis, I was dialyzing. Well, the normal is 4 times a day, but because I was so small, I couldn't, my body couldn't take the 1-liter bags. So they had to put the bags in half, and I actually had to dialyze 5 times a day.
And that's how many, and that's an hour per?
About an hour, yes.
About an hour. So that's 5 hours out of your day.
Yes.
Just basically laying there, being hooked up to a bag. That's basically flushing your system, right? Putting fluids in and taking fluids out.
So, and I would do things in between. You know, I'll go grocery shopping or go have coffee with a friend, or, you know, I would definitely do things in between. But there are options out there for, like, even here in Scottsdale, not far from here, there's a dialysis center. And they can actually, on peritoneal, which is the dialysis that I had, they can actually, for instance, in 2009, before my second transplant, I bought a ticket to see Bruce in San Jose.
You've seen Bruce a lot.
I know. I talked to my nephrologist and I said, okay, you know, and I was just starting dialysis for the second time. I was, I just bought a ticket to see Bruce in San Jose. You know, how do I go about getting the all the supplies that I need shipped to the hotel? Because they will do that. They'll ship it to the hotel so that you can dialyze in your hotel room. And I mean, because I have to make this work. And he just looked at me and he went, you're not going to San Jose. You've just started dialysis. You're not going. Because it was like a month from then. And I went, really? And he went, no, Tina, you really can't go to San Jose. So I sold my ticket and I thought, okay, what are the other concerts to go to? But they will do that. If you let them know that you're going to be, you know, in a hotel, they ship the supplies directly to the hotel and you can dialyze from there.
But amazing.
They've come a long way now, because the peritoneal dialysis that they actually do now is a hookup overnight. So you have the machine at home and you dialyze at night while you're sleeping. So it gives you more freedom through the day.
Yeah, that is better. Because otherwise, if you're there or you're just like reading books or watching a movie, like it just passing the time while you're there.
Yeah.
And is it the kind of machine, like if you were to roll over at night, do you have to worry about anything pulling out?
That I'm not sure of, because I haven't actually had it. Like the next time, hopefully there won't be a next time, but if there is a next time that I have to go on dialysis, that's what I will be on. I'll have the machine at home and I'll just dialyze through the night.
That'd be
and
good.
Then it'll give me, And, but the next time, if there is a next time, hands down, I would choose peritoneal dialysis again, because it gives you more freedom and you feel healthier for longer.
So that's good to know. And so now, is it okay if I ask again, can I ask your age? I know that's kind of rude to ask somebody their age. My mother used to get really mad if I asked somebody their age.
I asked her age once
and got in trouble. But, we were taught not to do that when we were kids. And I'm like, sorry, Mom, I'm breaking the rules.
You know what? When my mom passed away in 1981, actually, that's another thing. I came to Canada in the March of 81 and my mom passed away in the September.
Oh, geez.
So I didn't even know how old she was when she passed away. She would never tell us.
Yeah,
so I only got to know how old she was by her death certificate. But
they just didn't talk about it back then. That's why I thought, is it rude of me to ask your age?
No,
I just wanted to ask how old you are, because it's just to show people, you know, they're listening.
I'm going to be 66 on the 7th of March.
Oh, you don't even look like it. Good grief. I would have never guessed.
Yeah,
I would have never guessed.
Last year was all excited because I got my old age security at 65.
Hey, that's a good thing. That's awesome. So good for you. So look at all the things you're doing, you know, like look at that, the hiking and the biking and traveling around and enjoying life. And you know, it sounds to me, obviously, you're very careful with everything.
Oh, yes.
You don't take anything for granted. You look after yourself. Diet-wise, do you have to eat anything differently now? Is there anything you have to watch? You can have whatever. If you want to have a hamburger, you can have
whatever. Cakes.
Hey, that's pretty good.
Chocolate.
That's a good thing.
I'm a chocoholic. My husband calls me the Prosecco princess because I do like my Prosecco. But no, I'm not restricted at all into it. Obviously, you know, I don't eat a lot of junk food because I try to stay healthy. Because should I need another kidney transplant, you have to be healthy. You have to be pretty healthy to have one. As I said, I told you at the beginning, this is something that I will never take for granted, never.
Oh. And you know, I hope people listening to this story today will realize how important it is to never take anything for granted, especially when it comes to our health.
Yes.
Especially for that, you know.
Yeah.
You got one body to live in, you got to look after it.
You know, when I was going through chemo, I said, you know what? I'm going to live every day like it's my last. And I do. And, you know, I
but
love
on the
animals.
Joyous side. You do it with gratitude and fun. That's how you
And I'm still sending those letters to the donor families every 5 years. And because I think that's important, because I don't know, I'm just assuming, but if I had a family member pass away and donate organs, I think I would want to know how that person is living their life.
Yeah.
And so that's what I do.
And if they didn't want to know, they could let the organization know, right? If they don't want to hear about it. And have you ever heard back, or is that something that wouldn't happen?
No, I've never. I mean, I guess it could happen. They could always send a letter through the coordinators, but no, I haven't had that happen. But and that's fine. That's okay. Yeah. I just want them to know how I'm doing and what I've been able to accomplish
because
of their selfless gift of life. Because it is a gift of life. So
it is a gift. And I think we are so lucky to have heard your story today. We
really are.
I really appreciate that you took the time out of your day to come on the show and share your story, you know, with our listeners.
Thank you.
It's amazing. And I hope lots of people will share this episode with other people, because you truly are an inspiration to people around you. And, you know, they talk about the attitude of gratitude. Well, you have that attitude of gratitude. You're a ray of sunshine. You view the glasses more than half full.
Yeah.
You view it as pretty close to the top, what I would say.
Yeah,
you've got a great outlook on life, and you've given us such a good reminder as to why to celebrate life, enjoy every day, make the most of every day.
Exactly.
And also, you know, if you've ever considered having your name on the list to donate an organ, how much it can make a difference in the life of somebody else.
Yes, and if this interview gets one person to sign the donor card, then my job is done. And have that conversation with their family. That's the most important thing.
Well, I appreciate you sharing
that. Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. So what's your plans for the rest of the day? What mountains are you climbing today? Or is it already too late in the day? Have you already done today?
No, it's only 11 o'clock in the morning here. So I'm going to go out for a nice long walk now, I think.
I love it. That is great. Well, I think I'm going to do the same thing. I have a little poodle scratching at the door now, so I got to go let him in. I think I'm going to have to go get him outside. But thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on the show, and hopefully we can stay in touch. Find out how things are going. I would love that.
Okay,
all right. Well, have a great day and enjoy hiking. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please click like, share on your social media, and hit that subscribe button for future updates. Don't forget to join the Lindy's Audio Cafe podcast group on Facebook or visit www.lindysaudiocafe.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember when you head out that smiles come in all languages and in all colors.